opinions voiced in Investing Simplified with Bo Caldwell are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine what may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial or tax advisor prior to investing. Investors cannot invest directly in indexes. The performance of any index is not indicative of the performance of any investment and does not take into account the effects of inflation and the fees and expenses associated with investing. Guests on Investing Simplified are not affiliated with CWM LLC. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Price Financial Group, wealth management.
We do Investing Simplified. Welcome into Investing Simplified. However you're listening to us today, thank you for making us a part of your day. Reminder, if you missed this week's show or you missed any portion of it, you'd like to listen to a replay of previous shows, you can find those at www.pricefg.com or anywhere you get your podcasts, whether that's Apple, iTunes, Spotify, Google Music, and the like. And Matt, I want you to know, you weren't here last week, Matt, but I struggled explaining to folks that now, you know, officially we have rebranded to pricefg.com because it's a little bit easier than pfgwm.com. And that time I got it. I didn't mess it up.
It
so
it only took you a minute, but
it took me a long time. So obviously taking me weeks to get it figured out because I'm not
as used to saying it. pfgwm.com, now pricefg.com.
It just rolls right off the tongue. Luckily, if you go to pfgwm.com or you send an email to pfgwm, we still get it. We still, we keep that there.
Just both domains, and we'll continue to do this.
Making it a little bit easier for folks to understand. Well, Matt, it's
simplifying investing. Simplifying.
Hey, right, that's the name of the show. There you go.
That's what we're. That was the idea.
It's a work in progress.
But we've got Mr. May in the office here in our studio this week. So we missed you last week, but we did have.
Sorry, I couldn't make it.
Some general questions. Bo and I did unofficially admit on air that you were correct in thinking that, there may be a little bit of rotation out of tech into value. But
that interest rates may or may not be going up.
Yeah, but
it did seem rather fortuitous. That has
And we did say that it happening. Could have gone either way, but a couple
grudgingly,
of questions.
Grudgingly, we gave you credit.
Yeah,
as but you should.
And we moved on really quickly from that point. Just so you don't get, I don't know, if you probably listened, so I'm sure you listened to the show.
And my ego can inflate with the U.S. dollar.
So it brings up a couple of questions, right? So first question would be inflation. Where does it go from here? Numbers came in, I think, a little bit lower than expected, but there's a word on the streets that inflation in the next a little while will be a little bit higher because we're comparing year over year, and we had that dip in after March. And then the second question, and you can take it from there, is now that we've seen this rotation, where do we go from here? How long does it last? How to stay well diversified and balanced? I know it's a lot of words.
No pressure or anything.
No pressure.
Basically, you just want to know everything about what's about.
Yeah. Just give us the magical solution.
Exactly what is going to come tomorrow, the next day, and the next day after that in the markets.
Here's my general sense is that we had such a big move. I mean, NASDAQ officially hit correction territory. So from its all-time high, it pulled back 10% or more. That's the definition of correction. So we hit that. And then we saw a little bit of a reversal, and that was driven primarily by the increase in interest rates, particularly in the 10-year treasury and some of those longer dated U.S. government bonds, etc. So rates did climb really quickly. We talked about that as well. Hopefully I got some credit for that.
A little bit.
But, we talked about that was one of the dangers of owning those fixed income investments that are driven by just pure math. If rates go up, the values of those go down. For the most part, that's how they work. It's just a function of math. So rates did climb really quickly. And that from a growth perspective, if I'm a growth company and interest rates increase, that does devalue the future of our growth opportunity. So that's why some of those tech names got hit a little harder than others. Plus, they were in nosebleed territory, to quote one of our clients, is like, gosh, I've got these investments that are in nosebleed territory. They were really, really expensive.
Yeah.
So my expectation is kind of what we're seeing right now is just it probably will be the wave that pushed up and then just kind of crashes and recedes a little bit before it continues higher. So it might be a little bit of a break on the, you know, hopefully be a break on the increase in interest rates, because that does tend to put the foot on the brakes for the overall growth sector.
I see. It's like throwing some water, cold water on an overheated engine.
It does. Yeah. So I think that'll, the rates will kind of normalize a little bit before they resume their march higher. That's the overall expectation when we're stimulating the economy as much as we are. Of course, we have the big package that was signed by the president, and that's $1.9 trillion rolling out over the next several years.
I would suspect by now lots of people are getting deposits that went out right away.
Right, but the stimulus is just part of it, right?
Yeah,
the stimulus that he signed a few weeks ago is part of it, but additionally, then you have infrastructure spending, right? There's other pieces to it.
Right, that's kind of the expectation of inflation, though, is that with so many dollars being infused into the economy, and it's not just the government, there's also the Fed that's buying a lot of bonds, U.S. government bonds and mortgage-backed securities, so they're dumping a lot of money in there. There's the expectation that there's a bunch of cash on the sidelines and people are getting vaccinated left and right, and that eventually our economic doors will come swinging open, and there's all this pent-up demand where people are going to have a lot of cash to spend and a lot of demand to spend that money, and that will drive economic activity. And when you have those many forces pushing the kind of that inflation number higher, it's definitely a pretty solid potential that we would see increased inflation, higher inflation. So
yeah, I mentioned last week, I was telling Matt, it reminds me, it's reminiscent of the Spanish flu in 1918, right? Had a bunch of, global pandemic, lots of people died, it's very sad. But then once you get through that, where you get to the vaccine and you get this pent-up demand is released, then you have the roaring 20s, right? It's a lot of spending and you have this, boom of economic growth, right?
Yeah, so I wouldn't expect that those names that pulled back so much over the last, 2, 3, 4 weeks or longer, I don't expect that those are going to continue their downward trend like that. I would expect that over time, those are still solid opportunities. I would just say that I find other areas of the market around the globe a little bit more appealing than those names. They're just trading a little bit more expensive. So I still like the areas like emerging markets, small cap value, even though they've had a pretty tremendous run. I also like the cyclicals. We're seeing a little bit of that rotation out of the tech names, some of the other names that had done really well in the quote-unquote COVID trade. Now we're switching gears, hopefully, into the recovery trade. And those make that kind of rotation makes those cyclical stocks a little bit more attractive.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a nice opportunity, right? This always the idea is you want to buy high quality companies that are on sale. I wonder, can you speak a little bit? We talked a little bit last week. I had, a listener, from a few weeks ago that she had mentioned that, hey, felt like we were sort of poo-pooing individual stock ownership. And, I know it sounds like that when we talk about the way that we manage money and the way that we look at a diversified portfolio, but owning, whether it's, these big tech names or whether it's individual, if you're owning good quality companies, individual stocks can really be a good plan for building wealth over time, as long as you're not over concentrated.
I think you've hit the nail on the head, just making sure you're not over concentrated. And from a practice standpoint for us, we're the three advisors that we're the engine of the investment side of this whole practice. And realistically, feasibly, do we have the time to sit there and do due diligence on all of those individual companies? I mean, you're talking earnings and cash flow statements and all those releases, the 10K filings, and to make sure that a company is a solid investment to entrust our clients' dollars to put into those individual names. Or we can look at some of those high quality money managers out there that have a proven track record. As long as that track record doesn't, blow up on us. If it does, then we might think about making some changes there. But my preference personally is to make sure that we're looking at first and foremost building that foundation of someone's portfolio using either a diversified passive strategy, diversified actively managed strategy, or a blend of those two before we would start adding those individual securities. Because you're right. I mean, they can, you know, it always is nice to have that GameStop that we bought at $20 that went to $400 in a week or something crazy like that. But, you know, the opposite can certainly happen. And we don't play with a lot of just play money here. We play with people's serious long-term retirement mm-hmm. money, and it's just not worth taking the risk for the most part on that kind of investment.
Right. And, you know, just from our standpoint, you know,
just from our standpoint, like what we're doing for an investor, for a individual investor, a DIY kind of looking at what's out there. I mean, certainly within that, we feel you shouldn't have more than 5% of your investment, your liquid investments in any one particular investment, like single company.
Yeah.
That doesn't say that you can't put more than 5% in a diversified ETF or mutual fund. That you can maybe look at like 15 to 25%, depending on how many companies that ETF or mutual fund may own.
And we still use individual positions. We just use baskets of them for different segments, right? So we would, instead of using one, we'd use, you know, a dozen per se, let's say in a category where we feel like that would be better suited than maybe using a fund or an ETF or some sort. So.
Right. Well, and you do have the folks that have, hey, I bought 100 shares of Amazon at $65 in 2008 and now, you know, now that's, you know, trading, you know, above $3,000 a share,
or,
you know, I bought Microsoft in the 80s and then bought more in the 90s and then just kept letting the dividends reinvest. And over time it can build real wealth. That's not what we're saying. Don't do that, because you're not, again, at that point, 100 shares of Amazon at $65, $6,500. And so if that, now that's worth, you know, a couple hundred thousand 15 years later. Right. But it, you know, at the time, it wasn't your entire life savings. The key about the one stock or individual stocks is that you're not putting your entire life savings, you know, you're not betting everything on one. You're not going diamond hands and YOLO on things because of something you saw on the internet and people are, you know, are buying it up. Because that's for all the people that made a lot of money, you mentioned GameStop, but for all the people that made a lot of money in that Reddit frenzy, there were just as many, if not more, that lost a lot of money, because that's how stocks work, right? In order for you to buy and to sell it, somebody has to be buying it,
right?
And somebody has to lose money, right? If you're making money, it's a zero sum game, right?
Got in the elevator at the top of the building, and then,
right?
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. But, and I know I'll probably go on break soon. But last week we talked about five things that I brought to the table regarding retirement plans. And this week, since I figured it might be a nice trend to start, I have another list. This time it's a list of five reasons why you should compare you to you and not to an index or your neighbor, which kind of it's sort of in the same realm of what we're discussing here in general, that why should a person, not look at specific index to compare themselves, you know? So we could talk about that after the break.
But it's very difficult to do, because I look at my neighbor and I'm like, gosh, their yard looks so nice. I gotta have a nice yard like that. Or look at that new car. It's like, oh, I gotta have it. We compete with the Joneses. Certainly.
It's a hard thing not to. Human nature.
Absolutely. And of course, also within human nature is only sharing the big wins. We never come back from the casino telling the story about how we sank $500 in and lost most of it. It's like, oh, I put $20 in and I won $100.
Yeah, I pulled the quarter slot machine and walked away with 30. But I don't explain to my wife that that third down to the quarter, because 300 of it went away at the blackjack table. It's human nature. Well, and, you know, this, you may not know this, Matt, but this comes, from Carl Jepsen, you know, the late, great Carl Jepsen, who was on the show with Chuck for a lot of years.
Yep.
He always would bring his, you know, his Carl's comments.
His usually were a little longer section than five. But
he had nice lists. And so the idea we did last week, and I think we'll continue it here after we take a quick break, but is, you know, Matt has a list that he brings, and then we, you know, we'll go over it and then discuss kind of our thoughts on the different things. So that's a nice tease, Matt. So we'll be back after this break with the five reasons five reasons to compare you to you. And not to your neighbor or to some index, right? So if you have a question about our outlook, what's changing in the markets, if you haven't really looked at, you know, what good opportunities there are, if you'd like to sit down with Matt and powwow about those, you know, what investment's going to join the nosebleed section next, or what he likes to think about, then we're happy to talk to you about what we see out there. Give us a call, 503-253-3000, or visit us at pricefg.com. www.pricefg.com. That's www.pricefg.com. We'll be right back with more Investing Simplified.
Leaving an employer can be stressful and overwhelming, but once the dust settles and you're at a new job or perhaps retired, it is important to consider your options for that retirement plan left behind. If this situation applies and you would like to hear more about options available for 401k, 403b, or other retirement account rollovers, please give our office a call at 503-253-3000 to schedule a complimentary consultation with someone on the team to go over your specific and individual situation. We will take the time to get to know you, your goals, and let you know what the best course of action is for you and your family.
We do Investing Simplified.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. If you're just now joining us, we spent a little time earlier talking about markets, about updates and what we see coming, and we got a very professional tease from yes. Mr. Matt Sudol about his list, you know, in reference, you know, we're paying homage to the late Carl Jepsen with, you know, his Carl's comments. And these are, we need to think of something that has alliteration like Carl's comments for you, Matt.
We can just call him Carl's comment as a memory. I mean, I don't think he'd mind.
I don't think he would mind, but they're not Carl's, they're yours. They're Matt's.
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe Matt's musings, I'll work on it. I'll come up with something better. I can do better than that. But right anyway,
now, I kind of liked it. It's like,
Matt's musings. Yeah. Well, anyway, these are the five things reasons. Or five reasons you should compare you to you and not to your neighbor or to an index, right?
Exactly.
And so as a reminder, folks, we're going to have Matt go through the five reasons, and then we'll spend some time going over each of them. We'll talk amongst ourselves.
Yeah, in more detail, we can have a little bit of a discussion. But here's five coming at you. Number one, risk tolerance, you know. Mm-hmm. Number two, goals. Number three, amount of money saved. Number four, your time horizon. And number five, your needs versus your wants. See, what I did there this week is I only gave you the first couple of words. Last time I explained them more, but you were thinking, oh, you're giving it too much. But this time I just gave you a little tease. So take it from the top. We can talk about them. Number one, risk tolerance, you know, can you handle the swings? So,
yeah, that's a big one for me. Yeah. I mean, it's so relative. There's so many different ways to play the investment world. And if you have to really spend a lot of time to sit there and compare yourself apples to apples to anybody else or anything else out there. I mean, it's really, really difficult as a risk manager to compare and to offer a suggestion to a client that says, hey, for the identical risk that you're taking now with your portfolio, here's something that I see that might be a little bit better, but with the same risk. So risk tolerance is so incredibly important when you're talking apples to apples. I didn't get 16.24% in 2020. How come? Well, because you're a risk level 30 on a scale of 1 to 99, well, and those investments only got like 7-8% last year.
So it's sort of going back to don't compare yourself to an index, because index has a different risk-adjusted return, and the risk is completely different. And then don't compare yourself to the neighbor, because your neighbor could be 20 years younger than you and could have completely a different risk profile and also tolerance, because some of the risk is simple numbers and some of it's also emotional, right? How much can you handle? There's people that are in their 70s that are like, let's go ahead and crank this up because I'm okay with it, and they say go big or go home. But then there's also people that are, you know, maybe in their 50s and they're like, man, I don't want to lose a dime, so I want to be very conservative. So there's two.
It's so relative. Yeah, absolutely relative.
So that's why it's on the list. But then moving on, number two, goals, and I said, you know, I wrote myself a note here, you know, what is the money really meant for? And that's huge, you know, because if the money is being saved for like a down payment on a house or something versus is it meant for your retirement, is it for college, you know?
Yeah, the goals and how far out are those goals. It kind of relates to one of the other
further ones,
line items. Mm-hmm. But the goals is an important aspect of it, because if you're shooting for those big targets, you really need to pay close attention to the level of risk you're taking, how long you're mm-hmm. going to be, how long that money is supposed to work. So goal is a very important piece of it.
And then if you think about it in connection with your neighbor has completely different goals. As you were talking about your lawn, you know, your goals are different than your neighbor's. You know, you're more probably, hey, as long as the bushes aren't too overgrown or too crazy, I'm okay. Versus your neighbor might be there with, you know, a tiny scissors cutting the grass with a ruler.
With a ruler, just to make sure it's the right diameter.
Because the goals are different, right? And so both are okay, because if somebody's driving away from far away, they really won't see that big of a difference potentially. But if you get into it, they are different. The goal of an index.
The grass is always greener on the other side, though. that's the way that works.
And then on the flip side, goals of an index. The index doesn't have a goal. The goal of the index is just to mimic what the underlying securities are going to do. So if the S&P doesn't say, oh, okay, this year, you know, S&P, let's get all the companies, let's get 10%. No, they don't do that. It's just, okay, what will the index grow by? What will the economies grow by? What will the world grow by? So that's why it's hard to talk about goals. Number three would be, and I think this is an important one, amount of money saved. Small pool of money versus a large pool of money. And I think that's huge. The bigger your pool of money is, the more risk you can take on, right? And the more real options you have. Because if you have $5 million saved and you can have a great retirement, $2 million, that the other three you can really be very aggressive with. And it, you can compare yourself to your neighbor who may have a lot less, or it could be, somebody has got $50 million. And so that's important. You know,
I would agree too. And that's also an apples to apples comparison, especially when people use raw numbers. Like, I made $5,000 last week in that investment.
Yeah.
Well, did they tell you that was on a $50,000 investment or a $150,000 investment? Right. It's like, it's that amount of gain.
$500,000 investment.
Right? Yeah. I mean, $5,000 could be a whole ton if they have $200 invested. You made five grand. I would say sell it. Probably a good time to think about taking some gains on that. Is that long-term cap gains or is that in an IRA or Roth? I would be asking.
Yeah. And if you have somebody that maybe has, you know, $300,000 saved in retirement and it's got to last them for 30 years, and so they got to be more frugal, conservative, and safe with it, you know, that is a completely different, conversation than somebody with $3 million or even $600,000. So it's all relevant, dependent on what are you doing, which is why comparing yourself to the index or to your neighbor don't always make sense. They very rarely do, unless you're very close with your neighbor and you happen to be like twins or something.
Or you're really focused on making an accurate comparison. Like, if you're comparing yourself to an index like the S&P 500, just know, hey, S&P 500, which is now a 76 on Riskalyze. I've been saying 75 for a long time, but apparently they bumped it to a 76
anybody
now.
Anybody as new to anybody new listening or haven't heard Matt really likes our Riskalyze tool to assess the risk. And basically what it is, it's our risk assessment tool that goes from 1 to 99, 1 being cash, 99 being like single securities. And what happened was, I told him the other day, and I think that made his day, that
something changed on there.
Went from 75 to 76, which has been 75 probably for a while.
Oh, ever since I've used it.
So that's big. I mean, it just means that S&P currently, according to the tool, has a little bit more risk than it used to.
Yeah. So if you're comparing yourself to an S&P 500, you got to make sure you know your number and you know what the S&P 500 is. The S&P 500 we know is a 76. What are you? You got to run it through some sort of risk analysis, or put pen to paper on it.
The next one you sort of started talking about was the time horizon, and I think this is one where it's again important to talk about. Where is it a 3 to 5 year time horizon on the money? Maybe you're buying you want to buy a vacation house, and hey, I'm going to retire in 5 years. That's what I'm going to do that and buy it. Or is this for retirement that's going to happen in 20 years? Right. So there's a big difference. So again, comparing yourself to an index versus your neighbor too, an index doesn't, it just continues to go. I mean, it doesn't have an end. We talked about this actually, I think Bo brought this up before, where he talks about Warren Buffett and how the way he invests. He invests for the insurance company, which has really a perpetuity in terms of the length of time it's going to, so the money can sit there forever. Most humans aren't going to live forever. So there's a defined timeline that
most of us won't.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Elon Musk has the best shot.
He does. So
downloading himself into a robot.
Oh yeah, totally.
And then with your neighbor,
he's halfway there already.
Your neighbor is the same thing. You know, your neighbor might have completely different time horizon, maybe different ages, maybe different goals. So again, it seems simple when I bring it up. Like, hey, you're right. You know, that makes sense. Comparison, it doesn't make, you know, doesn't always suit you well if you just do that. It's one of those things when you were growing up. I remember when I was younger, I would stand up next to a friend of mine's like, who's taller, right? And you'd compare yourself, but you were different spurts, you know, and then summer would go by and I would catch up or he'd get ahead.
It's like you're in second grade and you're comparing yourself to a high schooler. That's not fair.
It's like, why am I as tall as this guy? Well, that's because
you're try harder.
Yeah, different time and ages. So
yeah, so time horizon also kind of relates to your goals too, because you know I would think from a logic perspective, the shorter the time horizon, it does dictate, in my eyes, a lower tolerance for risk.
Yeah,
like if you're going to spend this money in 6 months a year, you probably don't want to be.
Oh, you don't even want to probably invest it at all. Almost at that point,
maybe a 5 on a scale of 1 to 99, something like that.
Well, and Bo and I brought this up on the last show where it is challenging. The more conservative you are, and the shorter your timeline, that limits your investment options, because you can only pick very conserved options to a point, and then with bond prices potentially coming down because of rates going up, there's additional risks that people don't think about. And the last thing you want to do is, hey, I want to buy a house in 2 years and put your down payment in something and it's just gone down in value. That would be awful.
That's tough. So, that's a tough pill.
Last one to put a bow on this and have a discussion is
a bow. I get it. Yes. A different bow. Bo was like, heard that one before.
I don't think I have, so that's good. Need versus a want. And this kind of goes into two things. One, you know, when you do a financial plan, or when we do a financial plan for people, we try to address the needs first, right? So make sure that, you know, whatever you need to get, you know, bills paid and have a great retirement are met. Then if we have the additional buffer, you know, based on a Monte Carlo simulation and statistics and probability, if we have room, then we talk about the wants, right? If, oh, hey, you know, you can meet all these goals, but then you can also pay for this wedding for your kids, or you can leave an estate or fund college. What's important to note, though, is it also, you know, couples with like returns in the market, where what return do you need based on your plan versus what you want? And the want is going to push you towards FOMOing, right? Going fear of missing out. And you're just like, oh, man, but my neighbor's getting 10%. I should do what he's doing. And then maybe you shouldn't, because you can be meeting all your goals and maybe some of your wants at, let's say, a 6% return. So why go farther than that?
That's a tough one. You know, it's a tough sell, because
yeah, it is.
We're inherently competitive by nature for a large
time. Yeah, and everybody has that, you know, nobody wants to miss out on stuff, right? And it's like, oh, well, man, the market was up 20% and I only got 12. Well, no, think about it this way. You got 12%. That's a huge return. And if the market didn't get 20, if you were down, you know, the market could have been down 30. And you only were down, you know, 15. That's a big win in my book. So it's important to, again, index and a neighbor, you know. All of these factors I just went through, all of those are completely different, and you shouldn't be comparing yourself to that.
Yeah, what do you need your money to be doing?
Yeah, and this is kind of exactly what I was going for. So what do you need for you? Meaning, what's the plan you've put together with your financial professional? And then how are you tracking to those goals you've outlined based on the allocation, investments, the strategies you're deploying, right?
Right, because once you buy into the strategy of what you need to accomplish with your money, the rest becomes noise, and you don't necessarily make decisions based on the noise. You make decisions based on what you need to do with your money.
No, so if let's say you're needing 6% and 1 year you get 10. Great, you got yourself a little bit of a buffer for a year or two later where maybe the return, you know, goes down, because it's all going to be based on averages. But if the market sells off a ton, you're not sitting there like, oh man, what did I do? I just followed what my neighbor told me to do.
Yeah. My advisor didn't tell me to get out, or my neighbor didn't tell me to get out. It's like,
yeah, well, the index fell. How is the S&P 500 is down? And I am too, you know, and what happened? Maybe you FOMO'd into the market. Maybe you got cut up and everything's going up and everybody's making money. Let me make some money too. And then you buy it, as you said, the elevator's all the way at the top. This is when you jump on. Oh, wait, where are you going? Oh, we're going down to the first floor, or, you know, halfway down.
Good news. It's 2007. It'll only take you 5 years to get back to the floor you were on.
And so it's important.
That's a tough ride.
And some of these could be, you know, potential mistakes. And so avoiding those is important. And the younger you are, the more time you have to make up any mistakes you've made, right? But as you get older and as you get into retirement, you're not going to want to go back to work, you know? That's one of those things where we talk about work optional. Well, it truly should be. You don't want to be like, hey, boss, so I know I retired a year ago, but things, the elevator we were on just went the wrong way and my neighbor was wrong. So could I pick up some hours? You know, you don't want to be in that position.
Right. Always be focusing on that income that you need for the next year or two, especially in retirement. You don't want to be tapping into any type of portfolio that's down like it was last year. I mean, we said before, but imagine you had a big expense come up in the middle of March last year and mm-hmm. you had to tap into the markets. It just got done dropping 34% in a calendar month. So we strenuously recommend to our clients that we need to focus on at least a year, preferably two, maybe even more of specified dollars of where we are going to go if we need income.
Yeah, that's important.
Low risk, something that's not going to be riding that big roller coaster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's kind of wraps up my list. And then maybe we can talk more about what other things people could be doing. And then I know we had some questions that have come up too. We could talk about that after our break.
I did have a question from one of my clients this week. And I wanted to put it out to you guys because this is more of a planning question, CFP question. She asked me about umbrella insurance, and I know enough to be dangerous, but what do you think is the right amount of coverage with an umbrella policy? So let's chat about that on our next segment.
We can. I know Costco sells them for what, $15 to $20 umbrellas?
wrong umbrellas, Matt.
Oh.
He had me too. I was like,
it's like, wait,
what are you talking about, Costco? No.
We are in Portland. Yeah.
Those types of umbrellas are not supported in this town.
Right. That is not what
we're
you
not
meant.
An umbrella town.
I knew that. Right? I knew that.
You do get judged here in Portland umbrellas. So I think that's a good point. It's a nice tease. I mean, we're getting really good at this tease thing, guys. But if you have a question about, you know, you've been feeling like you've been comparing yourself to your neighbor, the things that, you know, Matt just talked about are, well, my neighbor says they're conservative and they're crushing me on their investments or vice versa, right? You just don't know how to benchmark properly.
That's a good point. I'm conservative. Like, are you a conservative 60 on a scale, or are you a conservative 40?
Are you actually conservative? And if you're concerned about whether your portfolio actually matches your true risk tolerance, because that's a big thing, right? You know, I've had people talk about, well, I thought my risk tolerance was X, but actually it's Y, mm-hmm. because they actually went through a downswing. But if it's been a while since you reviewed that, or you just never have and you'd like to get that complimentary review with a professional, with a fiduciary firm like ours, give us a call, 503-253-3000, or visit us at www.pricefg.com. We'll be right back with more Investing Simplified.
When planning for income and retirement, there's a lot to consider. Between managing the budget that fits the family, trying to figure out from where to draw your income, or balancing the tax ramifications of withdrawals, moving into retirement can be overwhelming. At Price Financial Group, we help clients work to create a sustainable retirement roadmap, addressing these concerns and more, and helping folks feel confident in their future retirement income, right when they need it most. If you'd like a financial plan tailored just for you, please don't hesitate and call our office today at 503-253-3000 or text REVIEW to 484848 to set up your complimentary consultation. Price Financial Group offers investment advisory services through CWM LLC, an SEC registered investment advisory firm.
We do Investing Simplified.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. So as we close out the show, I think it's become kind of rote for us to go over some questions we get from listeners, from clients, from some questions that they've asked, you know, us to share over the airs, but if you have airs over the air, but if you have a question that's been keeping you up at night, something that's been bugging you, you've been wondering about, we'd love to talk about maybe how we can answer it, right? Maybe we can get you the, and if we don't know the answer, we will find out the answer from the experts. But shoot that question to AskBo, A-S-K-B-O at pricefg.com, or leave it at investingsimplifiedradio.com. We'd love, if it's something that's been bugging you, something you've been wondering about, there, I can guarantee you that someone else out there that is listening has been wondering that same question too, and you can certainly help it out. You don't have to call in and be live on air. You can shoot that question to us and be totally anonymous. Won't share any of your information. So, mm-hmm. Matt, you had a question that, you know, we had from a listener that had come in, and you asked it and we teased it, and then I was fooled in turn.
I'm buying at Costco. How's this now? I got to compete with Costco for umbrellas.
Right, right. So what, so tell me a little bit more. So the question had to do with umbrella insurance, right? But so can you flesh it out a little bit for us?
Yeah, so it actually stumped me because it isn't my specialty, and that's why I'm happy to be partnered with folks such as you that are certified financial planners. That's nice. So the question that she had was, should I get an umbrella policy? And if so, how much coverage should I get?
Sure. That's a tough question. And so we can start.
Umbrella, you know, insurance, umbrella, not actual umbrellas, man. Different question. And so one thing before we jump into it too is part of, because umbrellas really cover liability insurance. So your insurance for your home also has levels of liability insurance, but then you want to couple them with a potential liability insurance through an umbrella. And an umbrella is sort of, the name speaks for itself. When you open up an umbrella, everything under the umbrella is covered. So if you were to create, let's say, $1 million umbrella, all your assets are protected by that $1 million. And so if you get sued, hopefully you don't, but if you get sued, you know, somebody can sue you for X amount of dollars. If you have an umbrella policy, that's where it comes in. So I don't know if there's a lot of rule of thumbs per se, but I usually will tell people if you have a rental property, probably a good idea. As your net worth increases, it's a very good idea, I think. If you have, you know, significant assets that you've saved and you've worked hard on, you might as well protect them. Most of the time, the umbrella policies are pretty inexpensive. Now, I will say that we actually don't deal with those at all. You want to talk with your property and casualty insurance agent.
If you're wondering, property and casualty would be whoever you get your car insurance, yep, or car, home insurance.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But they're not very expensive, you know, a couple $300 for, let's say, $1 million. Now, they do get spendy, I believe, at around $5 million. If you want to get over $5 million, and you got to get some more underwriting happening, and that's because the insurance company's like, wait a minute, you need $5 million, huh? What's going on? Because, you know, there's a lot of $1 million policies or $2 million policies, but if once you're getting up there in a number, and you're pushing up at $5 million, that's a lot more liability for them. But basically what you're doing with any insurance, and we could talk about other insurances too if we've got time today, is you're transferring liability from yourself to the insurance company, right? I mean, if you had a car accident, it's a really bad car accident, the car insurance has certain liability coverage, but it's usually, you know, maybe $200,000 to $300,000. But if it's a really bad accident, you know, knock on wood here, if there's death or something, somebody could potentially sue for more, and the umbrella will protect you. Otherwise, they could go after your personal assets because you're personally liable for an accident. So it's good to have, for sure.
All right. So when you say, like, the type of assets that it will cover, like, what typically would that explain more about that? Like, how could I relate it back to her as far as what would be a good fit for her? Like, how, I guess what I'm asking is, how do I know what the right coverage amount is for her?
Oh, sure.
Far as like what we're trying to protect.
Yeah. So it's kind of like we could talk about like term insurance and life insurance and such. It works in a similar way, but it covers you, I would say, for what are you worth? So how much are you worth if you were to get sued? So if somebody could sue you and get away with taking $1 million out of your net worth, then you should cover yourself for an equivalent amount, so then you can direct that over to.
It's also, you know, it's not just that part of it. So kind of go, you mentioned a little bit from the umbrella policy. So your homeowner's policy covers, mm-hmm, certain incidents that happen in and around your home, right? Right. So someone comes over to your house, they fall down, they trip down the stairs and break their leg, right? You are liable for that because it's in your home, right? And so the homeowner's insurance, to a certain extent, depending on your policy, covers a certain amount of that liability. you're driving a car, right? Your car insurance to a certain amount of liability, up to a certain point, depending on your car insurance, covers that liability,
yeah.
right? So, but hypothetically, you're driving down the street, you get in an accident, you rear-end a car. The person you rear-end is a world-renowned plastic surgeon, and in that accident, he loses a finger, right? So now he conceivably is going, because you're at fault in that accident, is going to maybe sue you because he has lost his lifetime income because he's a world-renowned plastic surgeon, lost a finger, can no longer do plastic surgery, right? So then he conceivably gets litigious and sues you. Now, normally your car insurance and covers you up to a certain amount of liability. That's what Matt said, right?
Yeah.
$25,000, $50,000, depending on what that insurance is, right? So the umbrella combines your homeowners and it extends your homeowner's insurance not to just cover what happens in your home. You could be walking your dog and somehow the dog gets off a leash and goes running up and barking at a nice old lady who is walking her dog and she falls and cracks her head open on the curb. You're liable for that. Right. And your homeowners doesn't cover that. Your liability, your car insurance, you need an umbrella policy. Right. So
okay.
The way that the umbrella policy works is, and as Matt said, it is very inexpensive. My umbrella policy that I have for myself, I have $2 million of the coverage. It's $340 a year. Right. It's super cheap to cover for $2 million. And it doesn't always mean you need it. It's sort of like the extra protection from having the homeowner's insurance. And in reality, you know, like any other insurance, it hurts to pay for it because most likely you're not going to need it and hopefully you won't need it. But it's catastrophic sort of protection, right? The idea is you're protecting your assets. And what Matt said, a big reference point is how much do you have that people could go after, right? Because if you don't have a large amount of assets, you don't have a lot of equity in your house.
Yeah, you may not need it.
Because they could sue you for all that sort of stuff. Now, hopefully this never happens and you never need it and you've just been spending $300 a year for however long. But if you think about $300 a year, 20 years, what's that, $6,000 to have protected $2 million, mm-hmm. right? It's not that big a deal.
If the liability is greater than your insurance, you're on the hook for the difference. Mm-hmm.
And so this is by no means that I know this stuff, but from, I feel like one of my agents or somebody I've spoken to before said that if you have a policy, you're less likely to get sued for more. They'll settle with the amount you have coverage for. Because they're like, oh, hey, he's got $1 million, umbrella. Let's just settle for $1 million, move on. We know we can get that because it's covered, and otherwise you'd have to go to court. Because it's not, the insurance company that's providing the $1 million policy, they'll be like, okay, cool, we'll pay it and we'll move on. And that's the other reason to have it. Personal, like as Bo was saying, if your net worth isn't really high, you don't have a ton to lose per se, may not need it. You want to consult with a professional, talk to an advisor too. I mean, part of what we do is when we sit down with folks, we do review homeowners and liability insurance in general terms. We don't get into the nitty gritty, but making sure they have enough coverage, they have the right replacement values and all of those in the policies.
Deductibles too.
Keep eyes on that. Making sure those are, set properly. But if you have, I think one of the biggest reasons why I tell people to get the umbrella policy is if they have personal rental properties. Because rental properties, something could happen at that property and that's all it takes, where if a tenant gets injured or something and then, you've got the house, that's an asset that they're renting. So the tenant may think, oh man, this guy's got a rental property. He's worth a bunch of money. Let's go after it. Right. So it's, that's actually, I had a rental property and that's the first time I've ever started a umbrella policy. I don't actually currently have a rental, but I've kept the policy and I intend to do so in future. But that was the other use, is if you have rental properties. If you have younger drivers in a family, I think is a good one. Many reasons. As Bo said, the coverage isn't that expensive.
And a lot of times it actually lowers, talk to your property and casualty agent, but my car insurance, my homeowner's premium actually went down.
Yeah, because
I added the umbrella. Now, did it go down $340 a year? No. But so it ends up giving you a discount on the umbrella policy. So for pretty cheap, it can make sense to have, that extra protection. It behooves the question, though. So, right, we've talked about this before, insurance-wise, and, whether you have too much insurance or too little insurance. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the deductible idea, right? So on an insurance policy, and I've brought that up before, right, where, hey, if I'm backing out of the driveway and I clip the edge, there's a post out there, and our office over in Mall 205 area that we don't have anymore but had those big white posts, right? So I clip that big white post, and it just down the side of my car. And I'm looking and saying, okay, well, if I take that, if I, it, you know, it's going to cost $700, just, you know, make a, it's going to cost $700 to fix that. Am I going to go make a claim to my insurance company, try to get the insurance company to pay it, and then my premiums go up, or am I just going to pay it out of pocket?
Right. Because then if you make a claim, then any future time that you apply for insurance, you are asked, hey, have you ever had a claim? And you have to check the yes box. And then all of a sudden, you know, that generally means rates are going up for you.
And you may not even have enough. I mean, the deductible might be $500.
Right. So, well, but that's the idea is like, so if you have a, a lot of people try to get those lower deductibles, right? Because they think I want a lower deductible. It means a higher premium, but a lower deductible. But if you have a $250 deductible, $750 repair, are you going to really go get the claim, still have to shell out $500, or are you just going to pay the $750? And that's different for everybody, right? That's a different conversation for everybody. But, you know, I personally raised my deductibles because I figured out what, here's what the range is. You know, you could be $1,000. A lot of times it's round numbers, but maybe $1,000, that's where I draw the line, right? Where, okay, I'll pay the first $1,000, but it gets above that. And it can, it doesn't always, but it can, you know, have significant savings for
it. It could save. And I would say that what I would do is I would work that, you know, extra deductible amount into your emergency savings. So you have that buffer. So for when it happens, so if you have that extra $1,000 saved in a savings account, you're kind of insuring yourself for the deductible, and then you can save a little bit each month. That's a good idea. Not to switch gears too much, but we talked about an umbrella policy. And an umbrella policy, I think, you know, the older you get, the more likely you is that you need it. And I think it's one of those where you keep it throughout the latter part of your life. On the flip side, I did have a couple people ask me, at what point do they need to worry about continuing term life insurance? We talked about that, you know, term life insurance before. And so if you're younger, you know, we talk about that if you have a mortgage, you have kids, if you're married, you know, you're sort of getting established, you need term insurance to cover all of those aspects. And we've broken this down in previous shows as to what kind of goes into it. But at what point in your life, or is it a net worth number, at what point in your life can you just not worry about having a term policy?
That's a really good question. It's tough, right? I think it really depends on your personal situation, right?
Yeah, it does.
Because it depends on what are you protecting, right? That's the question I always ask. Because, you know, oftentimes folks have met with an agent that only sells life insurance. They are holding themselves out as a holistic financial advisor, but really they're just selling insurance. Which is, you need that life insurance if you have things to protect, right? And there's different formulas. We have gone over the formula before about how much life insurance you should have. And most people hear of term and think of term because it is the cheapest, highest leverage way to get insurance, right? Right. Insurance companies love selling term insurance because most likely you don't die. Less than 1% of term policies actually pay out, right? But at what point do you not need to have that term insurance anymore? It really depends on what you're protecting, right? Because term is going to end at some point. So generally speaking, like a rule of thumb thing, I'd think about if you're thinking about what do I need term insurance for, right? Do I have debts to pay off? Am I still working? Would my, you know, basically the general frame of reference or rule of thumb that I use is if I passed away, would my spouse, my significant other, my kids, whoever is, you know, depending, if I have people depending on me, would they be okay?
Yeah.
Right. And if you can honestly answer that, whether you with, because you have enough assets saved up, if they have the house paid off, X, Y, and Z, if you passed away, not emotionally, we're not talking about emotionally, but financially, would you be comfortable with where they are if you passed away tomorrow, then you don't need term insurance.
Yeah.
Yep.
Does that make sense?
Yep. And I find it to be generally at times a sliding scale, that the further somebody makes it in their lifespan, that their assets are growing. Hopefully they're saving and investing and those assets are growing. And they're also diligent about paying their bills and not getting over their skis in debt. So their liabilities, that debt is coming down while their assets are going up.
Yeah.
So generally you buy maybe a 20 or 30 or 40 year term policy decades in the past. And, you know, you're getting close to the end of that term. Hopefully you have a lot more assets than debt.
Right.
So the strategy would be to kind of analyze your situation. If you have those decades in front of you, maybe even before you have the need to protect that. So if this is a 25-year-old out of college in their first job, they're making decent money, the best time to buy insurance is when you're young and healthy. That's when the things are going to be the cheapest. So if you're 25 years old and you're thinking about a 40-year policy or a 30-year policy that covers you all the way out to 55, you may not need it right now. But if you're buying that long-term, you probably might need it in the future if you get married and then you have a family, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a concept. I'm not recommending that to anybody, but it's a concept to think about, that if you're going to be buying that term insurance, generally the younger you are, the cheaper it will be. And if you're buying a long period of time of coverage, you want to try to think about it at a younger age. And then that gliding scale, meaning the further you get into your lifespan, that your need for insurance generally goes down. And maybe think about even doing what's called a laddered strategy. Say you need $1 million now, and you only need $750,000.
Or you think you're only going to need $500,000 10 years from now.
Right. Yeah. So if you think you're in 10 years, your insurance need may go down $500,000. Let's buy a $500,000 policy for now and a $500,000 policy for the next 20 years. So the first policy would cover for 10 years. The second policy would cover for 20 years. So what happens at the 10-year mark? You've had $1 million of coverage for 10 years. Then that $500,000 drops off. You got another $500,000 of protection for the next 10 years. So there's different ways to really analyze that, but that might be a strategy to think about when you're looking at what's right for me in the insurance world.
And I think what you were kind of aiming at was becoming further and further self-insured, right? So the higher your net worth, the more likely you are to be able to self-insure. Your heirs will not need money to pay for XYZ because you've got the net worth, so maybe there's not need for it. But a lot of times, as you get older and older, people tend to think about life insurance as a means to pay or help pay estate taxes, as well as just creating liquidity in your estate. So if let's say you have, one reason why you maybe want to keep insurance or maybe even look at a permanent policy is, let's say you have a, $10 million net worth and all of it's tied up in real estate.
Right.
Well, if you passed away, great. The person inherits $10 million worth of real estate. But what if there's a liquidity need? How are they going to pay for state taxes are any?
Right. Generally, that's due like 9 months after the person passed away.
You have to file the estate tax return, but
Yeah. So, but liquidity is huge. Funeral expenses, anything else, all of that has to be included. So insurance is important.
Right. Well, just in making sure that you have the right amount and that you don't have too much, right? Yes. I think that's important. So if I feel like I always end shows with, if that applies to you, right? But if it has been something that's been on your mind and something that you've been thinking about reviewing, do we want to explore a laddered policy? Do I have too much? Do I need this anymore? Is this policy that I bought 20 years ago still good? Should I keep it? Give our office a call, 503-253-3000. We're happy to give you that complimentary review and tell you exactly what we think about it. And I'll give you an unbiased review of, hey, do we need to keep this? Do we need to get rid of it? All those different things. We're happy to meet you out here in Beaverton. We can meet you in Tigard, in Clackamas, or in Vancouver. We have offices all over the Portland metro area. We're also happy to meet you virtually. So give us a call, 503-253-3000, or visit us at pricefg.com. Thanks for tuning in today. This has been Investing Simplified. Price Financial Group, wealth management.
The opinions voiced in Investing Simplified with Bo Caldwell are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine what may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial, or tax advisor prior to investing. Investors cannot invest directly in indexes. The performance of any index is not indicative of the performance of any investment and does not take into account the effects of inflation and the fees and expenses associated with investing. Guests on Investing Simplified are not affiliated with CWM LLC. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.
Bryce Financial Group Wealth Management. Bryce Financial Group Wealth Management. Financial Group Wealth Management. Bryce Financial Group Wealth Management. We do investing simplified.
Legal matters are never easy, but they are especially difficult when they involve the most important people and aspects of your life. This is Taylor Cattell, founding partner of KG Law Group. It's important to have an attorney who cares about your unique circumstances and knows how to get the outcome that is best for you. At KG Law Group, we specialize in estate planning and family law, including wills, trusts, powers of attorney, guardianship, and divorce. At KG Law Group, we provide both expertise and compassion as we guide you through the complex legal landscape. We balance knowledge of the law with exemplary client service. Whether you're reacting to a crisis or planning for the future, we are here to help. If you need legal advice, give us a call today and schedule a consultation at 503-878-8948. That's 878-8948. Or visit us online at kglawgroup.com. That's kglawgroup.com, serving Oregon and Southwest Washington. KG Law Group, your family, your legacy.